This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Over the holiday period at the Shalashudas, I gave a few short observations on the various parashas that we passed through during the past few weeks. And in so doing, started developing a theme which I wish to tie together this evening and to attempt to extract from it the underlying principle. The shiur, the title of the shiur was given as Pleasure and Duty. And we're going to be discussing specifically the relationship between pleasure and duty. The conflict between pleasure and duty, but not the legitimacy of pleasure per se. That's a different discussion altogether. The fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam designed the world in such a way to give us pleasure, that's a clear fact that we are entitled to enjoy certain things, and we're entitled to have pleasure. We're going to be analyzing pleasure in a specific framework. The facts of the legitimacy of pleasure per se, we learn in these parashas themselves. When Yosef was sent down to Mitzrayim, you'll remember the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that the caravan on which he was transported was carrying spices and perfumes and all sorts of sweet smelling things. And the Torah tells us that in order to show the chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam, to show the kindness of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that while the tzaddik, while Yosef was being transported away from his family, in an area where caravans are normally carrying hides and skins and foul-smelling things, the Ribbono Shel Olam went out of his way to make sure that miraculously that particular caravan was carrying sweet-smelling things. So why did it have to be carrying sweet-smelling things? It could have been carrying nothing. It could have been an empty carrying, returning from a caravan, returning from a trip. A caravan that had an unsuccessful mission, there could be many ways that the Ribbono Shel Olam could just have made sure that it didn't have anything foul-smelling. Why did it need to have perfumes and spices? But we see that that was part of the Ribbono Shel Olam's attempt to comfort Yosef, to make the trip a little bit more easy for him, to make it more pleasurable, and it was quite legitimate for Yosef to smell the beautiful perfumes and the beautiful spices and to find pleasure in them. You remember also there's a Rav Dessler, which I quoted once and my father quoted once, pointing out that part of the purpose of the stars, of that whole magnificent system of the stars, is to give man pleasure, so that in the dark nights you should be able to look up into the skies and see the little beautiful dots of light and to derive pleasure from that. And there's no question that through the diversity of color, through the diversity of tastes, through the diversity of sounds, the Ribbono Shel Olam intended man to find pleasure in the world. It's for that reason that we have brochas to say when we have pleasure. There's such a thing as a birkas hanenim, is the brocha to say for the pleasure that we do get from the world. So there's nothing wrong with pleasure per se, depending how it's derived and how it's utilized. But that's not the subject of the shiur. The subject of the shiur revolves around last week's observation that when after 22 years of being separated from his father, Yosef finally prepares to meet with his father, and the preparations have taken many, many months, the Torah tells us, Vayero Elov, Yosef appeared to his father, Vayipul al Tzavorov, and he fell upon his neck, Vayevka al Tzavorov Oyed, and he cried upon his neck further. And Rashi points out that Vayero Elov means Yosef Niro El Oviv. Yosef appeared to his father. And this gives rise to many people's question, and that is, what does it mean Yosef appeared to his father? They appeared to one another simultaneously. The moment Yosef appeared to his father also appeared to Yosef. So why does it say Vayero Elov? He appeared to him. When the Ribbono Shel Olam appeared to Avraham Avinu, it says Vayero Elov. He appeared to him because it was all of a sudden, that's how it happened, all of a sudden. Yosef, Avraham was sitting and he was aware of the presence of the Shekhinah, of Hashem's presence. So there it's proper to say Vayero Elov. Or if a person just comes upon you suddenly, Vayero Elov,
But here where Yaakov, where Yosef approaches Yaakov and puts his arms around him and kisses him and puts his head on his shoulder and cries against his neck, what does it mean, Vayera Elov, Yosef appeared to Yaakov? Surely it should say they appeared to one another, if it should say anything. And the answer that is given by the Baalei Musar, as I quoted last week, and this is where we need to analyze, is that in fact there were two different emotions in Yosef at that particular time. And one needs to identify them as different emotions. On the one hand, there was the burning desire of the son to be reunited with the father. There was this deep craving of Yosef to once again see his aging father Yaakov, to be able to speak to him, to be able to converse with him, to be able to share ideas and experiences with him. That was a very deep desire and ambition on the part of Yaakov, which he'd had for many, many years, for 22 years, on the part of Yosef. But similarly, there was a desire in Yaakov to see Yosef. The father also craved to see the child. These are two desires in each person. In Yaakov, the father is the desire to once again meet with his child, and in Yosef, there is the desire to meet with his father. And therefore, in Yosef himself, there must have been two emotions. The one emotion is to meet his father, and the other emotion is to give his father the nachas of meeting with him. He must have known too within himself how deep was the craving of his father to meet with him. And every son wants to give his father pleasure. How much more so a son such as Yosef to a father such as Yaakov. And so added to the desire and the craving within himself to derive the pleasure of the meeting, there was within him also the desire to provide his father with the pleasure of the meeting. To be mechabed his father, to honor his father, and to give his father the opportunity once again to be reunited with his beloved son. So they're two different emotions, both legitimate. Nothing wrong with either of them. A child is fully entitled to crave to be reunited with a father after 22 years of separation. And a child is fully entitled to want to give his father the pleasure of reunification after 22 years of separation. The Torah tells us, say the Baalei Musar, Vayera Elov, that in Yosef's mind, despite the two emotions, there was only one intent, and only one emotion was given expression to at this particular time. And that is the emotion of Vayera Elov, the emotion of Yosef wanting to appear to Yaakov. His own desire to see his father, his own desire to experience his father and to share experiences with his father, that was set aside. And Yosef utilizes his one emotion only and totally annihilates and sets aside the second emotion. All his energy, all his efforts, all his thoughts and all his intent go only towards giving his father the pleasure of Vayera Elov, of appearing once again to his father. Comes the question, why? Why did it have to be one at the expense of the other? And various different reasons are given, but the important thing to understand is that it appears from that interpretation of this pasuk that both emotions could not be given expression to simultaneously, that a choice had to be made. It was either a question of expressing his own desire to meet with his father, or of giving his father the pleasure of meeting with him. But the two together could not be done. And that's very peculiar. Because we know that the human being is capable of two emotions simultaneously, of more than two emotions simultaneously. We have many such examples. One is in the very case that I started off with, where Yosef was taken down in the caravan of camels to Egypt. And what was the caravan of camels carrying? We said it was carrying spices and sweet-smelling perfumes. Why? So that Yosef should have the pleasure of being able to enjoy them. And the Tzelzer Rav asks, is that all that was on Yosef's mind? Can you imagine this child being sold into slavery to a different, distant land, being torn away from his father, having to undertake oaths never to contact his father again? So he finds himself being what is in his mind permanently uprooted from his family and sent off. Does it make any difference to a child in such a situation, to a young man, whether there's perfume and spice on the camels on the caravan, or there's something else on the caravan, or no smell at all? Is he capable of enjoying the pleasure of the spices at the very moment that he was experiencing the agony of separation? And the Tzelzer Rav answers, yes, indeed. The human being is capable of conflicting emotions simultaneously. That's part of the richness of human feeling, that we can feel joy and sadness simultaneously, that we can feel agony and ecstasy simultaneously. We are able to feel mixed emotions. We are able to experience them and we are able to express them. And another example of that is the case where the Bnei Israel are crossing the Red Sea and the sea splits for them, they cross, and then the sea covers up again and the Egyptians are all killed. And you remember the Medrash where the angels started singing. And the Ribbono Shel Olam pounces upon the angels and says, "What right have you to be singing while my children are drowning in the sea? All the Egyptians are drowning and you're busy singing." And what the angel should have answered is, "So why don't you stop the Jews from singing?" At that very moment the Jews were singing "As Yoshua Moshe Bnei Israel," the Shira that we say every morning was being sung at that time. Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam not object to that song being sung? And the answer is, that's the difference between a human being and an angel. A human being can sing "As Yoshua Moshe" and at the same time feel a sense of pain at the fact that so much death needed to be caused for the salvation. And we experience that on Pesach when we take wine out of our glass, when we read the Ten Makkos. The whole of Pesach is the joy of liberation from Mitzrayim, is the celebration of freedom, it's a Yom Tov, the Simcha, and yet we're able to take a little wine out of our glasses. And we're able to diminish the Simcha just a little bit simultaneously without affecting our Simcha. We can experience the joy of salvation together with the pain of the suffering that death was necessary in order to achieve that salvation. A human being can do that. An angel cannot. An angel is not capable of two emotions simultaneously. And so when the angels were singing at the death of the Egyptians, the Ribbono Shel Olam got angry. You're entitled to sing because the Jews were saved, but you can't sing if Egyptians are dying. They're also my children. Not so the human being. He can experience two emotions. And if the human being can experience two emotions, our question comes back. Why was it necessary then for Yaakov, for Yosef, to exclude the emotion of his personal joy at seeing his father in order to give adequate expression to the second emotion of giving his father the pleasure of that meeting? Why did one have to be performed at the expense of the other? Why could Yosef not have enjoyed both simultaneously? Surely a son meeting a father after 22 years can feel at one and the same time I'm giving pleasure to my father and at the same time I'm enjoying seeing my father. Why can't one feel those two emotions simultaneously? And it's here that we come into this question of the conflict between pleasure and duty. Yosef has an obligation to appear before his father. His father and his Rebbe is coming after 22 years of separation. He's coming from a distant land. There's a halacha, there's a din, you've got to go and meet him. That's an obligation, that's a duty. The desire to meet with his father, that's a pleasure. There's no obligation, you don't have to be happy to see your father. There's no din. There's a din that you've got to honor your father, but there's no din that you have to feel happy. That's a natural emotion and a legitimate emotion. But it's an emotion of pleasure, whereas the meeting with the father from the father's viewpoint is one of duty. And this is the analysis that we need to make. And that is that we have several cases where we find the need to exclude pleasure from duty, which is not a Jewish kind of a concept on the surface. But duty should be without pleasure, the need to exclude pleasure from duty. Why? But we have such cases. And again, I must repeat what I opened with, that we're not discussing the legitimacy of pleasure. Pleasure is a very important part of human life, and one needs pleasure. What we're talking about is the pursuit of pleasure within an activity of duty. That's where we have to be careful. One example is given by Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, which is quite an amazing example. That's the example of lending money with interest. A terrible issue. Very serious thing. We get around it nowadays, we write a Heter Iske, we find ways to get around it. And the reason that we're allowed to get around it is because the rabbis realized that if this was not provided for, people would just stop lending money. It's not on the level. But still, we need to know the principle and we need to understand the principle. The principle is that to lend money with interest is a terrible issue. Very serious avera. And the Gemara has all sorts of terrible things to say about it. And all sorts of other averas, there's still a chance of finding some kind of understanding upstairs. When one comes afterwards and one has to explain, one will find that there's an ear willing to listen to excuses. But when it comes to lending money with interest, there's no tolerance at all. Nothing at all. It's very, very serious. Why is it so serious? That's, after all, the person's doing a chesed. The person is doing a kindness. He's lending money. The borrower wouldn't borrow the money if he didn't need it. And we're not even talking about exploiting the borrower. We're not even talking about borrowing, lending money with exorbitant rates of interest. Let us imagine a situation such as ours in this country at the moment. A situation where the rate of inflation, the government says is 14% and housewives say is 30%. So let us say that it's somewhere in between 20%. So you're looking at a rate of inflation of 20% with interest rates of 23%, 24%, 25%. Which is fair enough. Money is deteriorating. That means that the real interest rate is only a few percent. Fair enough. And a Jew comes along and goes to his friend and says, I need to borrow money. It's fine. How much do you need to borrow? I need to borrow 100,000 rand, 10,000 rand, or 1 rand. It doesn't make any difference. And the friend says, yes, you know, but things aren't what they used to be. There's inflation. By the time I get my money back from you in a year's time, it's going to be worth at least 20% less than it is now. 100,000 rand, that's a lot of money. I can't afford to take such a knock. If I had it invested, even in a cautious investment, I could make 15, 16%. I can't afford to go without 15, 16,000 rand. I can't afford to take that kind of knock. So I'll tell you what I'll do. Forget 15, 16%. I'll lend it to you for 5%. At least I get something on it. 5%? He says, that's wonderful. I'm willing to pay you 20%. At the bank, I can't get 20%. You don't have to. No, he says, 5% is enough. Well, you've saved my life, he says. My business was about to be closed, and my house was about to be taken away from me, and I wouldn't have been able to afford to send my children to Jewish schools anymore. I was about to be in the most terrible situation. And you have saved my life. 100,000 rand for a year at 5% interest. I can get myself back onto my feet. You've saved my life. And that Jew will come to the Ribbono Shel'olam after 120 years, and he will be punished too terribly for taking the 5%. What's the terrible thing? Chesed, you saved somebody, you're taking a loss. What you're charging him is far less than what it's costing you. It's a chesed. Why such terrible punishment for a chesed? And what would have been had he refused to lend the money? What would have been had he said, I'm sorry, I can't. To lend you with interest, I can't. And to lend you without interest, I can't. I'll arrange a guarantee. I'll stand a guarantee for you at the bank. They'll lend you the money. He goes to the bank manager and says, I need you to do me a favor. I've got a friend. I'll stand behind it. Lend him 100,000. The bank says, who? 100,000? For an unknown customer, not even one of our clients. Is he going to move out? Is the counter our bank? No, not going to. Says the bank manager, 28%. Says, no, okay, 28, what can you do? That's what it is. What will happen now when that Jew comes to Shammai? Very nice. You stood surety for him. You arranged a bank loan for him. You didn't charge him interest. The bank charged him interest. Nice. No punishment. Why not? How do we understand that? That for lending at 5% interest or at 1% interest or a 0.5% interest, there's a terrible avero. And for arranging a loan where much higher interest is charged, but by a goy, not by a Jew, that's fine. That's okay. Good. Sure, he will have to give account. Why didn't you lend the money yourself? You had an opportunity for a mitzvah. You weren't mekayim the mitzvah. Okay. But it's not the same as doing the Aveiro. It's not the same as transgressing the severe issue of interest. So we have a very peculiar halacha. We have a halacha where, despite the inherent kindness, the fact that incorporated in that kindness there is the benefit of interest, is serious. And it doesn't mean that the one wipes the other out. You'll get credit for lending the money, you'll get credit for the chesed, and you'll have to pay for the interest that you took. How do we understand that? Once again, the confusion between pleasure and duty. Lending money is a duty. Charging interest is a pleasure. And you can't mix the two. You want pleasure, and you go to the movies. You want to perform a duty, you lend money. Two different things. We're going to still have to analyze why. Why it's so serious. But this is a further example of that same concept. You want to give your father the pleasure of appearing before him, that's fine, but then no pleasure for yourself. Then you've got to do it lishmo, then you've got to do it with one thing in mind, and that's only to give your father pleasure. You want the pleasure yourself, fine, so then you do it. But then pretend that you're giving your father pleasure. And of course that's how the Heter Iska works. This whole, with interest, the whole way we work using the Heter Iska is a signed document which makes it very clear that the lender's intention is not chesed. That the lender's intention is not to help. The lender's intention is to gain. And there should be no confusion in the mind of the lender or the borrower. That's really what a Heter Iska is. Heter Iska means I'm going into a business deal with you. And people don't go into business to help, people go into business to gain. And that needs to be understood, because otherwise you get a very strange relationship between lender and borrower. Where I've often spoken about the fact that the bankers are the only people who somehow have managed to retain a sufficient aura that their customers tremble before them. Normally a customer goes into a place, he demands service, he demands goods, he demands competitive prices, and if he doesn't like it, he walks out. When you go to see your bank manager, the client goes to see the bank manager, it's also a client and a supplier, he supplies credit and I buy the credit. Who's trembling before the meeting? The bank manager is worried he might lose a client, or I'm worried he might pull in the overdraft? Who goes to the mikveh 10 times before they go and see the bank manager? That's how it works. They're the only ones who've done it. A confusion, they've managed to turn business and to give it an aura of chesed. This is not business, this is, you're jolly lucky that I'm even seeing you. And if I see you, that still doesn't mean that I'm going to help you, and that you're worthy of my help. And if I do consider you worthy of my help, then you'd better make sure that you remain worthy of my help. Because if at any stage you're no longer worthy of my help, I'll withdraw it from you. And you go out and say, thank you very much. You don't do that at the supermarket. You don't go, thank you for serving me, thank you for supplying me, may I come again? Do I have to send you my balance sheet before I come again? You don't do that. There it's a different relationship, because you understand there it's business, but the bank is chesed. That the Torah doesn't want. If it's chesed, no interest. If it's business, then let's have it clear that it's business, and you're in it to make money. That's what you're in it for, not to help people. And you're going to try and get the highest interest rate you can, and you're going to try and do the best deal you can for your shareholders, and you're not at all interested in your customer except as a possible source of revenue. That's the only thing it is. And that's the nature of the Heter Iska. Heter Iska is not a formality to legitimize the charging of interest while performing the chesed of lending money. The Heter Iska is a clarification of the relationship as one of business, not as one of helping. Different thing altogether. And the two must not be confused. Why not? The one level of taking it is a level that the Mesillas Yesharim takes it. And this is a very advanced level, and clearly it's not something that ordinary people like us are easily involved in, but it's important for us to know that there is such a concept and to understand the fineness of requirements that the Ribbono Shel Olam has from those people who are on that level. He says that Ma she'tzorich la'odom, in this perek on Tahar or perek Tezayin, Ma she'tzorich la'odom yoser iyunu melocha rabo. What a person needs a great deal of attention and enormous amounts of work is ta'aruvus ha'isu. Is not doing things which are blatantly wrong. That at the level that the Mesillas Yesharim is already holding on the 16th chapter, we're already talking about people who are well on their way to being tzaddikim already. And he says at this stage what you're worried about is not doing something wrong. You're not worried about profaning the Shabbos or not eating kosher or talking Lashon Hara. A person who's already on chapter 16 doesn't do that kind of thing. What we're worried about here is taruvus ha'isu, is the mixing in of small quantities of transgression into mitzvahs, that the mitzvah is not pure. The haynu that is shelifamim ha'odom ha'ilech v'yisei mitzvah lishmo mamish. Sometimes a person goes to do a mitzvah absolutely lishmo, with the best of intentions. Shekach gozer avinu shebashamayim. You'll say to him, why are you doing this mitzvah? He'll say, for one reason only, Hashem decreed it. Omnam lo yechdo milashate fimo eze pniyo acheres. But somehow there's sometimes a little bit of something else in it too. Hoshi shabchu b'nei odom. Sometimes it's to arouse the praise of other people. Sometimes it is she'ekabel schar b'ma'atzeihu, he's going to be rewarded for his deeds. V'lifamim afilim lo yimiskaven mamish lishu shabchu. And sometimes there isn't even any conscious intention at all for praise and for the approval of others. That's the mitzvah lishmo. However, bismach libra al hashvach, the joy that he feels when he is praised, yarbe ledakdeg yoser, makes him do it a little better. So you've got the fellow who's davening, and you say to him, why do you daven? He says, because the Rebbeinu Shlom says so. And if nobody in the world knew that you were davening, would you still davening? Yes. Would you daven exactly the same? Yes, there would be no difference. And he davens, and he stands with kavona, and he shuffles away, and he davens too beautifully. And then he overhears somebody at the back of the shul say, just look at that man davening. Isn't it a pleasure to look at the kavona? And that just gives him an extra boost to daven with still more kavona. So what's so terrible? He was davening with kavona to start with. His intentions were all l'shem shemayim. His intentions were all pure. Somebody said something and that motivated him still further. What's so terrible? And yet we have the case of the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyun. Shehoiso poisas psius yofus. She used to walk very nicely. And walking very nicely means she used to walk with tznius. She used to walk in a most modest way, in a very, very modest way. V'kivan sheshomo shoimim kamanois psius sheribo zu miyad dikdeko yosef. And once she heard a Roman soldier comment on how modestly she was walking, and she walked still more modestly. So we would say, very nice. So she takes praise from a non-Jewish observer, and she uses it still to motivate her avodas Hashem, her service of God, still further. And she suffers a terrible end as a result of that. Unbelievable punishment. What's the terrible thing? What did she do? I mention again, this is for tzaddikim of the level of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyun and his family. With ordinary people like us, the Rebbeinu Shlom would be only too pleased if, receiving the praise, we elevate ourselves a little further. But when it comes to a tzaddik, that's not what's required. So what's so terrible? Is that a reason to be punished? So here again we see the interest concept. Doing a mitzvah, and involved in the mitzvah itself, there is a degree of self-benefit which carries with it enormous consequences. Totally out of proportion on the surface. That whereas there's tremendous chesed in the lending of the money, the fact that that is tainted by the direct benefits, the commercial benefit, brings with it the suffering of enormous consequences. So it is in the case of the daughter of Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyun. Although she's walking modestly, and she walks still more modestly when she hears the comment, there is mixed in that act of mitzvah, in that very fine act of her modest walk, there is a degree of self-benefit, a degree of pleasure, which carries with it enormous consequences of the most terrible punishment. Why? The Mesidas Yeshorim explains it in the following way. Hine kishem she'en oilo al gabi ha-mizbeach shelemato el asoilis nekiyem anupu b'yud gimunapu. If you want to bring flour on the mizbeach, on the altar, it has to be sieved 13 times. It has to be absolutely fine. It has to be absolutely perfect. Anything that we want to bring on the altar, anything that we want to bring as a sacrifice, has to be absolutely perfect. And it's better not to bring a sacrifice at all than to bring an imperfect sacrifice. Kach i'efshar la'alos al ratzon mizbachoi ha'elyon li'yos me'avedos hokel ha'shleima b'hamuvcheres ela hamuvchor shebemaisim ha'tor mikol minei sid. So also, if one is bringing to the Ribbono Shel Olam, if one is bringing to God an action onto the altar, so to say, one is bringing a mitzvah, one is making a sacrifice for the Ribbono Shel Olam, it is required that that sacrifice is absolutely pure. And just as in the case of an animal or flower which is brought, there has to be absolute purity, so in this case as well, when one brings an action, that action needs to be absolutely pure. And if there is even the slightest bit of anything else included in it, that deprives it of its purity. Now we do have that concept in the material world too. You can find, for example, if I receive a letter in the mail, and it's one of the few letters that one still receives with a stamp on rather than with a franking mark on it, and a little corner of the stamp has been torn, the stamp is not perfect, I don't go into weeks of depression. It doesn't make any difference to me. The letter arrived, I really don't care. But if it's a very valuable stamp, if it's a very rare stamp, and it's very precious, and I would be a connoisseur of stamps and a collector of stamps, I would go into weeks of depression. Look what's happened. And you might say to me, but what's the big problem? Tiny little thing, it's hard, nothing. You've got to use a magnifying glass to notice that it's been torn. You don't understand these things. And I said, but all the other letters you've got, have a look at all the letters you've got today. Tell me how many stamps are perfect there. Go through, 50 letters came in, and only 2 out of the 50 are perfect. All the rest are a little bit torn. So why didn't you get upset there? It's the difference when you're dealing with something which is precious, when you're dealing with something which is unique, there needs to be absolute integrity, there needs to be total perfection. And the slightest imperfection doesn't just damage it. The slightest imperfection totally ruins it. That's how a korban works. Certain things, it doesn't matter if it's a little bit imperfect. But sometimes even the slightest imperfection ruins it. You take the knife that a sheikhet uses to slaughter, slightest imperfection ruins the knife. On our ordinary knives that we use at the table to cut the meat with, it doesn't matter if it's a little bit imperfect. But when we're dealing with something highly sophisticated, when we're dealing with something very special and very unique, it has to be perfect. And an imperfection cannot be measured by its size. An imperfection, when an imperfection is a quality problem, then it doesn't matter how small it is, because when you're dealing with quality, size is irrelevant. And if one appreciates the stamp not because it's a 5 rand stamp, but because it's an invaluable stamp, then one's talking about quality, not about quantity. And if one's appreciating the stamp for its quality, then the tiniest imperfection destroys its quality totally. It has no more quality. The quality is gone. For quality, there needs to be perfection. And so when one's bringing a korban, there needs to be perfection. So says the Mesilas Yesharim. When one's dealing in ordinary deeds, there doesn't have to be perfection. But when one's dealing with a mitzvah, there should be perfection. And the slightest imperfection ruins the mitzvah altogether. The Mesilas Yesharim goes on to say that doesn't mean, God forbid, that one doesn't get reward for the mitzvah. The mitzvah still has value and there still is reward. The Ribbono Shel Olam rewards everybody. But there's no question, Shelo Yikore Bezeh Hashem El Avodo HaTorah LeGamri. But it's not called pure service of God. To call it pure service of God, it has to be pure. And pure means absolutely no self-interest, absolutely no benefit at all. And so if we're going to look at duty as sacrifice, if we're going to see religious purpose in duty, if we're going to see something spiritual in duty, then there is a need for perfection in duty, which we don't find in other areas of human activity. If we're going to see, as for example in art we have that. You can say a person can be playing a violin concerto, and he plays it beautifully, except that one particular passage he plays flat. Just one note he plays flat. So you don't say, well, it was 99% okay. That's fine. It's totally ruined. That's just not good enough. Can't be. It's got to be 100% alright. When you're dealing with something in which you see a religious need for perfection, we cannot tolerate imperfection of any level whatever. And we need to develop the feeling for our Avodas Hashem, which we feel in areas such as art, lahavdil, and sport, lahavdil. You know, take South Africa, and one can't talk about art and culture in South Africa, but you can talk about sport, that people understand. You know, talk about a fellow plays a game of soccer, and it's all okay, just not quite up to it in one particular place. That spoils the whole thing. It ruins the professionalism. It's not there, it's not the same. And you can't measure it and say, well, it's only out of 2 hours of playing, it was only 1.5 minutes of bad playing. It's not so bad. That ruins everything, that wrecks everything. It's not good enough. When one's dealing with quality, the slightest imperfection deprives the action of quality altogether. And the trouble is, we don't tend to see our Avodas Hashem in that light. We don't tend to view it in the light that needs, that requires perfection. that we can understand it a little bit further too. And that is that even from a pleasure point of view, there are two sources of human pleasure. There is a physical source for pleasure and there's a spiritual source for pleasure. And the underlying difference between spiritual and physical pleasure is the direction of the pleasure. Is the pleasure from... Well, let's preface it by saying in either case, the common denominator is that the pleasure comes from feeling alive. The things we do for pleasure are all things that make us feel alive. And that's why people will sometimes do risky things for pleasure, because it makes them feel alive. We discussed that once before, that coming close to death makes you feel alive. So people will climb mountains and they'll drive motor cars very fast and they'll do all sorts of things to make sure that they're feeling alive. They'll smoke cigarettes to feel alive. They'll do all sorts of things to make themselves feel that they're alive. But that feeling of being alive can come from one of two sources. The one is external stimulation, and the other is internal motivation. For example, if I derive pleasure from an external stimulant, it might be from food that I eat, or it might be from a joke that somebody tells me, or entertainment that somebody has provided for me, I feel alive. Because I wouldn't respond, I wouldn't react if I wasn't alive. The fact that I am capable of feeling pleasure, the fact that I am able to respond with a feeling of pleasure, is a reconfirmation that I'm alive. And the more pleasure I'm able to feel, the more alive I feel that I am. But there's another way of feeling alive, and that is to judge the effect that I'm having on others. For example, imagine if everybody decided to play a nasty practical joke on you, and they decided to totally ignore you. You walked into a room and nobody noticed. You said something and nobody heard you. You asked for somebody and nobody attended to you. They're just as if you don't exist. People walk right into you. They don't apologize. They don't say sorry. They knock you over and walk on. And you shout out, you say, "Hey," and they don't even hear you. This is a practical joke where everybody's in on it. You're the only one who's not in on it, and they're out to totally ignore you. There comes a time where you begin to wonder whether you really exist or not. What's happening? And you have to resort to the feeling of stimulus to know that you're alive. You start touching things, you pinch yourself, you feel, am I alive or not? Yeah, then you feel, I must be. But there's a sense of questioning one's being alive if one feels that one is having no effect on one's surroundings. And in fact, at the point that we came in the Eeyore Shiur today, that was exactly the point that Eeyore had reached. Where he was no longer complaining about the fact that he was suffering physical illness and material pain that he could live with. What he was worried about is that he had no social effect, that nobody took any notice of him. That he had lost his potency, that he's lost his leadership. That there was nobody there that gave him any form of dignity or whatever. That caused him the greater suffering. And so we find that there are two ways of feeling alive. One can feel alive from what one receives, and one can feel alive from what one gives. Feeling alive from what one receives is only a sign of physical life. A person can be lying virtually in a coma, and if, so to say, he's able to respond to external stimuli, then he heaves a sigh of relief, and the doctors heave a sigh of relief. They prick him and they tickle him, and if he registers something, there's life there, there's something there. What kind of life? What kind of life is there? Sure, medically it's life, halachically it's life, biologically it's life, but spiritually, what kind of life is it really? Is that what we mean by life? Can he put on tefillin? Can he learn a black gemara? Can he communicate with his family? Can he do chesed? Can he make somebody happy? Nothing. What kind of life is that? But he's responding to stimuli. So the responding to stimuli is only evidence of biological life. It's not evidence of any intellectual life. It's not evidence of any spiritual life. It's not evidence of any real emotional life. People talk about falling in love. What does that mean? And they say they feel alive when they're in love. What does it really mean? Is it responding to an external stimulus? Or isn't it? And it usually is, because although people talk about love at first sight, it's usually love at first touch. They don't say that, but that's usually what it is. It's not normally love at first sight. People don't fall in love that easily. At first sight. At first touch, yes. That's physical stimulus. And even if it is love at first sight, what is it? It's also physical stimulus. You don't know the other person. Love at first sight, you say, where did you meet? Where did you fall? Love at first sight. What happened? We were at a party. I was in one side of the room. She was on the other side of the room. And the moment I saw her, I knew. What did you know? That she's a Baalas Midas? That she's a Tzadekis? That her family's got Yichus? What did you know exactly? All you knew was that you found her physically attractive. So what does that mean, that you fell in love? You're responding to a physical stimulus, which means you're physically alive, that's all. It has no emotional connotation at all beyond that. And that's why, as I always point out in marriage counseling sessions and in lectures and shiurim on marriage, stand outside the divorce courts and question the broken marriages as to whether they had love at first sight or they didn't have love. They all had love at first sight or second sight or soon after. They were all in love at one stage. Doesn't mean a thing. It's a physical stimulus, and the moment the physical presence is no longer stimulating, there's nothing whatever to hold it together. Not that response to physical stimulus is not important. Of course it's important. That's part of the pleasure with which we started. One is entitled. Pleasure is legitimate. We grow through pleasure. We live through pleasure. We utilize it. But that's not what we're discussing. We're discussing something much greater. And that is the response, that is the feeling alive, not through the responding to external stimuli, but the creation of responses in external objects. That's a much higher form of being alive. It's all very well to see the girl at the other side of the room and to fall in love. But to have the girl at the other side of the room see me and for her to fall in love, that's much greater. That means I'm alive. That means I'm able to communicate. I'm able to do something. And that's a completely different relationship between subject and object. Measuring my sense of being alive by the feelings and thoughts and actions I am able to create in other people. Can't do that if you're dead. You can't even do that if you're only physically alive and biologically alive. For that you need to be mentally alive and emotionally alive and spiritually alive. It's a completely different feeling of pleasure. A different type of pleasure. A feeling of spiritual and emotional and human potency. I can affect people. I can affect my environment. I can be master of my destiny. What is depression? When a person gets depressed, what are they suffering from? That they're not alive? Well, in a sense, yes, that's what they feel. They're not alive. And that's why they can become suicidal. Because the barrier between where they are and where they would be after suicide is not that far. They feel they're dead already. Why do they feel they're dead? They're dead. You tickle them and they laugh. You pinch them and they cry. They're able to respond to external stimuli, but they don't feel capable of creating stimuli for other people to respond to. That's the feedback that they're not getting. That's the cause of depression. The feeling that they are not in control of their environment is controlling them. If one is only responding to the external environment and not creating the environment and not controlling and manipulating and affecting the environment, what kind of stimulus is there? And really, that's the thrill that one gets in all sorts of interhuman interactions. When the performer gets onto the stage and he puts on a show and he gets a good applause, it's not the COVID. It's not just that he's getting the applause and now he feels good because he's being given honor. It's the fact that I could make those people want to clap for me. I could make those people enjoy themselves sufficiently to want to respond. That gives a sense of chayus. And so it is in all the relationships that we involve in, all the interaction, the salesman that goes out and does a good deal, the businessman that concludes a good deal. What does he feel about the fact that I could modify a person's attitudes? If the salesman goes in, I'll never forget when my wife and I went into a shop in Hong Kong. We were just looking around and we looked at a briefcase, I think it was, or a handbag. It was a leather shop. And I looked at the price and I did a conversion and I couldn't believe how cheap it was. and I was about to, just it was worthwhile buying it even if one didn't need it, just to buy such a material, it was just unbelievable. So I was already, my wallet was already out, and my wife said, hang on a second, wait. And she started with him. Is this really the price? How can you charge for this briefcase? How can you charge a price like that? Well, you're a tourist. Well, for a tourist, the 10% we can give up. It's 10%, she walks out. I was already so embarrassed, I was already out of the shop waiting for her. This went on. Eventually she got 60 or 70% off the price. And he came out then, the owner of the shop. He says, next time you come back, bring your wife. I don't want to deal with you. And then I realized the pleasure and the feeling of accomplishment in both sides. To go into a deal where you go in and you quote the price and the other person says straight away, fine, thank you. Deal done. Where's the pleasure? Who's the pleasure for? Both people feel worried afterwards. It was just too easy. There was something wrong. Where's the catch? When a person has to sweat and struggle a little bit, you feel, that was me. I did it. When you put your house on the market and you ask for 200,000 rand and a fellow comes along and he says, 200,000 rand you want for it? He says, look, I'll give you 150,000 rand. And you say, okay. Alright, deal done, pay 150,000 rand. Imagine a second scenario. Same fellow, same case, same house is on sale, 200,000 rand. The buyer comes along and says, 200,000 rand, I'll give you 150,000 rand. So he says, forget it. He says, alright, 155, he says, just that. He comes back a few days later, he says, are you still asking 200,000? He says, yes, but tomorrow it's going up to 220,000. He says, no, well, that's out of the question, but what's your lowest? What is your lowest? He says, 200,000 is my lowest. He says, I'll offer you 190. He says, forget it. He says, come on, 10,000 rand, what is 195. Okay, they do the deal at 195. Which buyer feels more satisfied? The one who paid 195 or the one who paid 150? Clearly the one who paid 195. Why? Where's the logic? That the one who paid 195 feels more satisfied than the one who paid 150 for the same house? The one feels, I did it. And the other feels, I was manipulated. He gave in immediately. I just said 150 and he said, yes, it's probably worth 100. The one who says 195 says, did I have to battle for this? He wanted 200 and I got him to give up that 5,000. I made him give it up. I got me. What's so important? Not the 5,000 rand that's so important. The fact that I'm alive. I can influence people. I can put an argument. I can persuade people. They take notice of me. A person needs to feel this give and take. He needs to feel the potency. That's the pleasure of living. But that's spiritual pleasure. That's not physical pleasure. Physical pleasure is measured in what you get. Spiritual measure effect is measured in how much you're capable of giving. The impression you're able to make on your surroundings measures your spiritual potency. And that's a different form of pleasure altogether. But when we view duty and pleasure in this way, then duty now becomes pleasurable. Duty now means doing those things which need to be done. But it's an outward pleasure. Duty now means creating the impact which needs to be created. And when we see duty in that sense, then we realize that there can be a severe conflict of interest between duty and pleasure in the normal sense of the word. So let's go back again to the case of interest. The man is being threatened with foreclosure, losing his home, losing everything he's got, and I step in and Baruch Hashem, I'm able to do it and to lend him 100,000 rand. What interest? Forget the interest. When do you want it back? When you're straight, don't worry. We'll talk, no problem, everything okay. And he gets over his difficult time and he gets himself back onto his feet and he becomes a responsible member of the community and he becomes a contributive member of the community and he sends his children to yeshivas and they become Talmidei Chachomim and he becomes a big Baal Chesed and a big Baal Tzedakah. Everything that happens to that family adds to my feeling of being alive. I had something to do with it. That was part of my creative ability. I noticed the opportunity for chesed. I responded to the opportunity for chesed. I was able to do it. But if at the same time there was self-interest, and years later when he's a contributive member of the community and his children are Talmidei Chachomim, and he's spent years in yeshiva, and I think to myself, I did it, yes, I did it, but I did jolly well out of it too. My investments were only getting 13% and from him I got 18%. Good, he would have had to pay more at the bank, but the fact is, my money did very well during that time as well. What does it mean really? that 18,000 rand that I made, that 18%, cost me the entire pleasure of the chesed. That's what it means, because it converts it from a duty into a pleasure, into a material pleasure. It makes it measurable. We once talked only a few shiurim ago about the measurable and the immeasurable. And when we're talking about spiritual pleasure, when we're talking about the pleasures of potency, the pleasures of creating, the pleasures of giving, those are pleasures which are not measurable. There is no way to measure it. Can you measure how much pleasure you gain when you're able to bring a smile onto a sick person's face? Are you able to measure how much pleasure you gain from the thrill and excitement on a little child's face when you give that child a birthday present that it really enjoys to receive? How much pleasure is that giving you? How do you measure that nachas? It has no measure. You cannot measure it. Because you're measuring life. You're measuring something spiritual. You're not measuring something material. And when a person takes interest for his loan, what he's doing is, he's measuring it. He's limiting it. And he's saying, all I want out of this chesed is 18,000 miserable rands. And with that I will be satisfied. Because it's 3,000 rand more than I could have got at the bank. So really what I'm getting out of it is 3,000 rands. And he's selling an olam habo for 3,000 rands. He's selling the joy and the pleasure both in this world and the next of a maisa chesed for a little bit of money. That's why interest becomes so critical. Not in itself. Not the fact that you're getting the pleasure. There's nothing wrong with doing business. There's nothing wrong with earning interest. But there's something wrong with trading spiritual for material. When you've got an opportunity for mitzvah, to sell the mitzvah and to take something material, who did that? That was what Esav did. B'chayro, rather have the food. And he trades. And we look at that and we say, how could a man do such a thing? To take something spiritual, his birthright, his b'chayro, all the brachas that come with it, and to sell that for a plate of food? But is that any more absurd than selling an olam habo for a few thousand rands of interest? Is it any different? It's an inability to realize the relative values and to realize that the one cannot be traded against the other. On the one hand, one's talking about immeasurable pleasure. On the other hand, one's talking about measurable pleasure. And so it is for Yosef, the pleasure to actually go to his father and to the pleasure of seeing his father. That's material pleasure. It's emotional. It's true that it's emotional. But there is an emotion which is spiritual and there's an emotion which is physical. And that emotion is primarily physical. The child's absolutely natural. There's nothing particularly human or spiritual about it. Even animals enjoy reunification after they've been separated, if the separation is not so long that they have no recollection whatever of one another. That's normally a biological emotion. It's not a spiritual emotion. But the emotion, the duty of providing pleasure to his father, that's something that has a spiritual value. That's kibud avim, that's a different thing altogether. And Yosef does not want to detract from the perfection of the giving pleasure by introducing any of the taking pleasure. Those two cannot be mixed. It's true you can mix emotions, but pleasures can only be mixed if they're all taking or they're all giving. The moment we mix the giving and taking pleasures, they actually detract from one another. There's less of both of them than if it was only one or the other. Moshe Rabbeinu is called an Eved, called a servant, a slave. It's a funny thing to call a king. Eved Naaman Karosalo, you called him a trusted slave. Moshe was a king. Why term him a slave? There's the beautiful story in Gemara Horius, where Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua were traveling on a ship. And Rabbi Gamliel had sandwiches with him. His wife gave him sandwiches. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda had sandwiches and flour. He came ready to do some baking on the ship. Shalim pised Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel's sandwiches got finished. And the ship wasn't at the harbor yet. Somach asulted Rabbi Yeshua. So he had to use some of Rabbi Yeshua's baking abilities and resources. On the way, so they were sitting down to a meal one day, long after Rabban Gamliel's sandwiches were finished. And he said to him, Mi ave your diet, the Havalan ikuva kulihai, the Isis Sulta. How did you know that we were going to be so delayed that you brought flour? fly. It means you knew that you couldn't bring enough sandwiches, they would go stale. So you must have known that the ship was going to be delayed. After all, it's not South African Airways or anything. What made you think that it was going to be so late? Amar Rei said to them, Keichov Echod L'Shivim Shona Oile. There is a particular star that every 70 years appears in the sky, Umat'e Et HaSaponim. And it causes the navigators confusion. They don't know about the star. It's once in 70 years, so it's once in a lifetime, not even of a navigator. He's never seen it before. So it's inevitable that he'll see the star and he'll confuse it, and he'll take the wrong turning. And I felt it was the time for the star to come, and it would cause this delay. He said to him, you know so much and you still have to travel on business. You should be a consultant, not a businessman. You don't have to buy and sell for a living. You can consult. You can sit in your office and consult to navigators. If you save the ships of the world, the travel of this traveling around once in 70 years, that's all you need to live for the rest of your life. Why are you traveling doing business? He answered him, Ad sha'ata tomo alai. Why do you ask questions to me? What's it your business? Back on dry land, you've got two Talmidim that are cleverer than me. Rabbi Elazar Chasmu, Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda. These are two people that can estimate how many drops of water there are in the sea. They have such superb geometrical or trigonometrical ability, such calculative ability, they can do that. Imagine what you can do with that knowledge. Firstly, it shows that again, you could be a consultant. Or you could gamble. Imagine you could take anybody off the street and bet them. I'll tell you how many drops of water in this glass, and you could do very well for yourself. And they don't have food to eat, and they don't have clothes to wear. They live in poverty, in abject poverty. So how can you ask me such a question? You've got it within your own school. People of enormous intellect who can't afford a living, they can't eat and drink. Nosan datu leishivan baroshi. Thought of it, Rabbi Gamliel thought that Rabbi Yeshua is quite right, and he decided as soon as he got home he would appoint them as Rosh Yeshiva and pay them a salary. Kesheolo, as soon as he got back, Sholach Lohim, he sent a message to them, V'loi Bo, and they didn't come. Chazar V'Sholach, he sent another message, I want to see you, Uvo, and they came a second time. Omar Lohim, he said, I know why you didn't come the first time. Ki medumim atem shesroro ani noisim lochem. You think I'm about to offer you a position of responsibility, of authority. You're wrong. I'm about to appoint you as slaves. I'm going to make you a Rosh Hashiva. I'm going to make you a Rov. You're going to be a slave. That's no authority. That's duty. That's not pleasure. You have the same concept. They didn't want it. They would rather go without food and without drink than to be in that situation. Avdus. What is the element of Avdus? Avdus is nothing for me. Nothing is mine. No pleasure is mine. My only pleasure is fulfilling the work of my master. That's what an Eved is. That's his pleasure. And by the way, it's important to be able to identify Avdus mentality. Because if you're dealing with somebody who has the mentality of a slave, don't think that you're offering him any pleasure by giving him freedom. One can't just classify people as slaves. There are many people who are free people who have the mentality of slaves, and there are many people who are slaves who have the mentality of free people. But there is such a thing as a person who has an Eved mentality, a person who's descended, truly descended, not just from anthropological speculation, but a person who's truly descended from Ham, has an Avdus mentality. And his Avdus mentality will mean that he gets greater pleasure from doing what you tell him to do than from allowing him to make his own decisions. And so if you have a domestic servant that's an Eved, in the old days there used to be such things in South Africa, if you have a domestic servant who's really an Eved mentality, never say to him or her, when you've got time, please clean the windows. And it doesn't have to be today, whenever you want, just do it whenever you want. That causes tension to an Eved. He doesn't enjoy that kind of thing. Does the madam want me to do it, or doesn't she want me to do it? Does she want the windows clean, or doesn't it? And if it's not so important to her, why should I do it? If you say, I want them clean, and I want them clean now, then he goes and he gets his bucket and his lappy, and he cleans the windows, and he feels a sense of accomplishment. And then you look at the windows and you say, beautiful, they're clean, lovely, and he starts to purr. Why is he purring? He's an Eved. He was fulfilled the will of his master. That's what an Eved loves to do. And that's an Eved Hashem. When we talk about an Eved Hashem, it's somebody who has clarity in what Hashem wants, and whose pleasure comes from fulfilling Hashem's will. That's an Eved. And we see here that Sororo and Avdus, the Jewish, the Torah understanding of authority and responsibility is one similar and identical, in fact, to Avdus, to slavery. Because in authority too, there can be no self-interest. In authority also, there has to be only the desire to do the duty and not to find any self-interest in it. Back to the interest theory, back to the to Yaakov, to Yosef and Yaakov. Once you're involved in Sororo, there can be no self-interest. And that's something that the world understands. It's interesting that in the last few years, with the deposing of so many dictators, there's been a number of common themes. And one of the themes has been exposing in the media the lifestyle of these dictators. How many shoes were in the dictator's wife's cupboards, and how many gold taps there were, and then the number of televisions and all that kind of thing. But that seems to be something which angers the people a great deal, and quite rightly so. Because what it's showing is that this was not a person doing his duty. So what do we say to ourselves? Let us imagine, not a case like the last dictator that was overthrown, but let us take a case of a dictator that did a good job of work. And he pulled his country's economy together, and he raised the standards of his inhabitants. But he used to pocket a lot of the taxes himself, and he had a nice fat bank account in Switzerland, and his children had bank accounts in Switzerland, and so on. But what he siphoned away for himself is a minute proportion of the enormous wealth he brought for his country. Do we accept that? Do we say, look, after all, what does it matter? So a few million went to themselves. So what? Billions came to the country. We don't say that. We're totally intolerant of the few millions or even the few thousands that went to himself. Why? Even find it in this country. You remember they found that the previous president went on a hunting party and used a government vehicle. So what? A government vehicle, how much did it cost the taxpayer exactly? Is that the biggest thing to be worried about? But people are intolerant of that. Don't accept it. When Yosef went to meet his father, he took government cars, took chariots. But three times the Torah tells us it was with the permission of Paro. He's the prime minister. These cars are given to him for his own use. He's going to bring his own father and family. Go and fetch them at the airport, that's all. Drive them into town. And Paro has already indicated he wants them to be received as royal visitors. Three times he checks up to make sure that there's no objection to him using government vehicles to bring his own father in from the airport. That's duty. And duty can entail no pleasure, no personal pleasure. The pleasure is only in the fulfillment of the duty. There dare not be any other pleasure. That puzzles it. That's like the little chip off the stamp. If you want to use ordinary stamps, if you don't want to work with connoisseurs, then it doesn't matter if there's a little chip off the stamp. But if you're a stamp collector and you want to use precious stamps, you've got to be careful. If you don't want the sororo, if you don't want the responsibility, you don't want to perform the duties, that's fine, then live like an ordinary person. A bit of pleasure, a bit of duty, a bit of responsibility, you can mix it all up together, it doesn't matter. But if you want to be the great dictator, if you want to be the king, if you want to be the melech or the prime minister, if you want to lead, then you've got to know that even the slightest bit of self-interest destroys the validity of all the good that's done. Can't be tolerated. It's an essential flaw, it's an inherent flaw which can't be there. And I mentioned in the title of the shiur the challenge of the 90s, because it's interesting that the century has gone through its backwards and forwards phases as far as pleasure and duty is concerned. The time of the First World War was a time of duty. A war had to be fought, reconstruction had to take place afterwards. Then there were the 20s, which was a time for pleasure and abandonment of duties. That was followed by the Great Depression. Back to duties. Pleasure took a back seat. So it was back to duty in the 1930s, then came the war in the 40s and the reconstruction in the 50s, 30 years of duty with very little pleasure. And then came the reaction in the 60s, pleasure with very little duty. 60s, 70s, 80s, 30 years once again, where we've actually felt the consequences of children raised on pleasure principles without duties, without responsibilities. And I mentioned in a shiur exactly 10 years ago that really started with the discovery of the pill in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. Was the introduction of the idea that the greatest human pleasure, together with the greatest human duty, which always used to go hand in hand, in order to experience the greatest human pleasure, you had to accept the greatest human responsibility.
sex had involved with it the creation of life. And from the 1960s that stopped. Now it became possible to have the greatest pleasure with no responsibility at all. That's what changed. And that introduced that whole atmosphere of the 60s, where it was possible to live for pleasure without the consequences, without the duty. And that was the 60s and the 70s and the terrible 80s. And now there's a change in the world. Or there's a change being talked about. It's too early to say. It's interesting, by the way, that this parasha is Vayechi, where it starts off and the Gemara says, the Rashi brings it, why is there no space between the previous parasha and Vayechi? And Rashi answers, because Yaakov wanted to predict the future for his children, and his eyes were closed, he couldn't see. It was withdrawn from him. And in a sense, we're in such a state at the moment. As I said, 10 years ago, I gave a shiur on the 80s. And listening back to the shiur, it's very interesting, because even 10 years later, it's all relevant. And one had an ability 10 years ago to look into the decade and to see where it was going. It wasn't that difficult to see where it was going, more or less, what the type of conflicts would be. And it was all quite predictable except for the last 6 months of the decade, that nobody was really able to predict. And now one finds oneself at a situation where if one says to anybody, what about the 90s? Where's it going? Can't see. Parshas Vayechi. Can't see where it's going. The changes are so radical and so fast. And the shifting in emphasis is so enormous in all fields. In politics, in the social field, in the scientific fields, in the religious fields. It's so vast. The shifting is so vast and so quick that nobody feels secure enough to say what direction it's going to take. It could take any direction. People are feeling a little bit complacent and judging the events in Europe as all very positive. But they're not necessarily so positive, because involved in those movements in Europe are vast numbers of people who are now going to want income and benefits in a capitalistic society. And they're not used to the understanding that pleasure involves a certain duty. In the communist countries, one could earn a living even if one wasn't making a contribution to society. And that's changing. And we're going into a situation where more and more people are supporting less and less people. In the United States alone, the size of the workforce is shrinking at an alarming rate. Because one is finding that a smaller proportion of people are supporting bigger birth rate, which means there are more children to be supported, more older people to be supported, because there's a longer life expectancy, more unemployed, more refugees. So you find that a very small part of the population is supporting a very big part of the population. The same is now going to be happening in Germany. The same is likely to be happening in most of Europe. So the whole of the strengths of the capital world are going to be hammered and burdened with enormous costs. And the democratic system gives the vote to everybody, irrespective of what you give. Anybody who takes gets a vote in the democratic system. You don't have to be a giver. If you have a social security number, you can vote. That means if you take, you can vote, even if you're not employed. And the majority of people are not employed. The majority of people are too young to be employed, or too old to be employed, or too sick to be employed, or too lazy to be employed. And they are the majority. So when it comes to the issue of, do we carry on supporting these people, the answer that the majority have to give is, you jolly well do. I'm the one who's deciding. So we're finding that the unproductive people who are going to be in the majority are the people who are going to be taking the political decisions. So I don't think that the world's going into such a wonderful phase at all. I think we're going to be faced with major challenges, the solutions to which I don't know who can see. But be that as it may, that's on economic and political fronts. But there's a new air on the moral front, on the ethical front, where there is an understanding that those 60s, 70s and 80s are over. That there's a new type of well-being that has to be sought after. Feminism is being de-emphasized, the importance of the family is being re-emphasized, the taking of responsibility is being understood, social responsibility, both in terms of companies taking social responsibility and individuals taking social responsibility and governments taking social responsibility. There's far more of an awareness of an ethical side to life, of a spiritual side to life, of a need to find pleasure in duty. Not to separate the two, not to find pleasure as an end in itself. And that perhaps is the challenge that the world faces more than anything over the next 10 years. And the challenge where the Jew can be particularly active in teaching the world the very essential principles of Avodas Hashem. And that is not to make an industry out of pleasure. Not to make an industry out of entertainment. But to teach people to find their pleasure and their entertainment in their duties. In the things they have to do. That's where to find the pleasure. That's where to find the fulfillment. First to define what has to be done. And if families is a duty, and work is a duty, and productivity is a duty, then one has to find one's pleasures within that framework. And not try and seek the receiving pleasure and the giving pleasure simultaneously. But to find that through making our presences felt, through making a contribution, through being potent and being creative, through changing our environment, we are in fact finding the greatest pleasure that there can be. The pleasure of feeling truly alive. Of feeling alive not only in an animal sense, but in a spiritual sense, in a creative sense, in the sense in which the Ribbono Shel Olam intended us to feel alive and to be alive.